Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View. Of course, I'm Adam Lowther, along with Jim Petrosky, Curtis McGiffin, the usual crowd. It's a bunch of old guys complaining about the world around them. And today we actually have a great topic. There was an article written by Dave Trachtenberg. And so for those of you that don't know Dave, he's a great guy. He's a friend of ours. And he's at the National Institutes for Public Policy. And he wrote a information series article called How the Lack of a Two-War Strategy Erodes Extended Deterrence and Assurance. And he basically makes the argument that the fact that we historically had a two-war strategy where we would be able to fight two regional conflicts at the same time. And sometime about the turn of the century, we went from fight one and hold the other to just one war strategy plus terrorism. And we've never gone back in this era of great power competition and conflict. We've never gone back to a two-war strategy. And so Dave's article talks about what that actually means. And it was a great opportunity to spur a conversation that is something akin to what Curtis and Jim and I have all been thinking about and trying to understand the implications for it. And so we thought we'd use Dave's article sort of as the spur to that horse to get going on it. So with that, let me turn it over to you first, Jim, because I always turn it over to Curtis. And so let's go to Jim first. And, you read the article. What was your take? And as the ground pounder in the group, as a career Army officer, you may have a different take on this than Curtis is the airman and I is the sailor do. So what was your take?
All right. Well, I'll take that setup as being the smart guy in the room. So, I appreciate that intro. So, yeah, I read through, and after I say I'm the smart guy in the group, I read this and I say I'm a little confused as to really the full context of this. And hopefully in this podcast, we'll actually sort that out. So maybe I'll lay a framework for that. For that confusion or whatever misunderstanding I have here, because if we look at the global situation right now, and even in some of the changes we made early in the 2000s, we've always looked at the globe as being multiple regions of instability. The problem I see, or maybe the conflict I have in my brain, is what type of conflict are we talking about? Are we talking about near peer conflict, two wars? Are we talking about a major war and a minor war? Which, if you think back to World War II, probably any war really we fought, there's always been a sideline group of people that we have to take on, and we have to have a strategy to make sure that does not impair us from taking on the main fight and losing that battle or losing that war. Now, Adam, I know in our past podcast, you say, well, we really haven't won any wars recently. So let's take a look at that. And that might be the context in which we're discussing here is how do you win a war? And how do you set yourself up in a strategy and in a position to fight those wars? And I think, those that have listened to us and I'm part of the crowd of the three of us together that tends to be very hawkish in this and saying, we need to have deployed forces. We need to have a show of force. We need to tamp things down early and show strength where it will deter our adversaries from trying anything, especially what I call the ankle biters, the ones that'll distract you from the main fight. And so from a ground pounding standpoint, I look at the situation and say, Where are we with regard to having deployed forces ready to fight battle against those smaller numbers when we fight the big peer? Now, maybe I'm off. So I'll use that as a setup for the both of you to sort of chew back at what I'm talking about.
Curtis, what was your take?
So I thought Dave's article was very poignant for this time in our collective lives here, with so much going on between, embroiled with supporting a war in Ukraine, supporting and partially engaged in a war in the Middle East on multiple fronts, and then sort of trying to maintain stability and deterrence in the Indo-Pacific region around Taiwan, and to some degree with regard to the Koreas. And so there's a lot of question about that. I thought Dave brought up some really good points, especially for those out there who are staunch believers in conventional deterrence, and that the idea that a strong military, that we can do with less nuclear weapons if we have a strong conventional military. And I think his article is an indictment on our inability to produce that strong conventional capability. When you add that to the rankings of the Heritage Foundation that did their military index for 24, you know, they graded the Army as marginal. They try to find my notes here. They graded the Army as marginal, barely able to produce enough capability for one major regional conflict. They graded the Navy as weak, where they only have 297 of the expected 400 ships that they should have in order to fulfill a 2MRC strategy. They rated the Air Force as very weak, as not being able to produce or meet the goals, with only having 897 combat-coded aircraft when they think they would need about 1,200. Of course, the Marine Corps always rates very strong. They rate the Space Force as marginal and the nuclear as marginal, taking those out, sort of combining of all the services. Very interesting report. I highly recommend. What's more interesting, though, is this idea of what is the 2MRC strategy? And it's really born from the end of the Cold War. And when in 92... Bush 41 set this base force idea, which was basically a 25% cut from the Cold War high, or wherever we were at the time of the fall of the Soviet Union. And I remember in his reelection campaign, it was, we were going to cut this far and no further. And of course, he lost, and the Clinton administration came into power, and with that came Les Aspin, a congressman who had been on the House Armed Services Committee for years, finally got to be the Secretary of Defense. And his goal was to come in to that program with a cleaver. And in an effort to try to cut the military and save money and all of these sorts of things, he did what was called a bottom-up review and created this idea of what is a 2MRC strategy, or which later evolved into a win, hold, win. And that got out into the public before they had really refined it. And so it sort of became political. And so they sort of held to this 2MRC strategy, even though there may be some delays built into it. And then that goes in through the 90s when the Quadrennial Defense Review shows up. But taking all of this into account, I'm not sure that we have ever had a 2MRC capability. And this is sort of my why I think that what Dave Trachtenberg is talking about is really somewhat of an indictment on our efforts. Because in the end, it has an impact on our allies and our meeting. And I'll leave the listeners with this before I pass it back. Very interesting in the... in the 1997 Quadrennial Defense Review, then Secretary of Defense Cohen made a statement where he said the two major, at that time it was called a major theater war, a major theater war requirement, was described as the defining capability of a superpower. A mere one theater capacity, quote, would risk undermining both deterrence and the credibility of U.S. security commitments in key regions of the world, unquote, and which would weaken in their minds the alliance network and any coalitions. The QDR stated flatly that if the U.S. dropped its ability to defeat aggression in more than one theater at a time, their standing, our standing as a global power, as a security partner of choice, and as a leader of the international community would be called into question. This is what we thought about in 1997. And I would argue this is what Dave Trachtenberg is talking about in 2024.
Hey, Curtis, before Adam jumps in there, I notice you rightly just ignored some of the things I said so you could get to your piece. And it was good piece. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying you were said anything bad. But the piece, and maybe you said it, so I'm just curious if you could do it or say something, is I looked at this. My problem with wrapping my head around this is, are we talking about just the convention? We're talking about nuclear. Are we talking about different components to different types? Either we talk about terrorism in areas. We talk about instabilities in regions versus primary war or peer-to-peer war. And I think that's different when you look at how we deploy our forces. Now, and I'll be again saying I'm the hawkish one here because I look at what happens on the ground. Because you know, no war is won until you get boots on the ground, and that those boots have to be on the ground to be safe and secure, and that region has to be safe and secure. And the piece I don't see in any of this is how do you maintain or develop a two or more. Because it really is more. There's going to be no two put their hands up and everyone else just ignore it. It's two or more, and you've got to put out the fires. And where does that presence come from? Now, I would argue you need more deployed forces, so you have more reaction, you have more capability on the ground, and there's no time lag for those fires to get out of control. That's sort of where I was heading with that. Maybe I didn't describe it well enough earlier.
Well, I think, Jim, to your question, and it's a good one, is that this is it's the answer's either, in that if you have more deployed forces, forward deployed forces, obviously you can react faster. But with that comes a logistical and political tail that has to be handled with host nations and these sorts of things. Sometimes they want you there, sometimes they don't want you there, and it, you know, it can just depend. And if you're not going to be there, then it's your ability to perform in an expeditionary manner. Can we get everything over there in a reasonable amount of time? And we spend a lot of time and money building a global air bridge and sea bridge in order to get everything over to a place. But that takes time. And when you don't encourage your allies to participate, or you don't allow them to have the right kind of weapon systems, and allow them to feel empowered to do those sorts of things without you, then that burden falls on you. And so the bottom line is you really can't be a superpower if you don't want to pay for it. And you can't be a leader power if you don't want to have your followers actually do what you want to lead them to do. And so you really can't be one or the other, right? You either have to rely on allies or don't, and expect it to be all on you and the American taxpayer.
I would submit to you that part of this challenge is, it's, you know, it's threefold. It's that, you know, if you go back and look at the size of the U.S. military in mid-1950s. It was 3.3 million active service members in a country of 130 million. We're now a country of 350 million, and we have 1.3 million. So we went from 2% of the population mm-hmm. on active service to 0.5% on active service. So we're smaller, and we can't even recruit that. So we're, you know, three times the size of the country, and we can't recruit one-fourth the same size relative to the population. And it's getting worse because the U.S. military is following the same strategy as the Boy Scouts of America. They're literally following the same strategy as the Boy Scouts of America.
We're selling cookies? They're going to start selling cookies?
No. That's not the BSA. They're
popcorn.
Following a strategy to their own demise. Hmm. Now, that's one part. Then the second part, so we don't have the people that it requires to have a two-war strategy. Then it's funding. So we're spending less as a percentage of GDP in peacetime.
That's right.
On the military than mm-hmm. ever. So if you looked historically prior to the beginning of the Great Society, and even after the early days of the Great Society, the Department of Defense was over half of all government spending. That's not GDP, because in World War II, military was half of all GDP to fight that war. But of government spending, it was over half. Now they're down to 15%. So we're spending, and we're still borrowing $1 trillion every 100 days, and it ain't to be spent on the military. So we're not spending. We don't have the people who want to serve. And then the second part is we're seeing the effectiveness of nuclear deterrence right now. Nuclear deterrence is proving highly effective. Let me explain what I mean. So if you look at the American response in Ukraine, it has proven that Russian nuclear deterrence is highly effective, because the United States is not supporting Ukraine in the way that it would like to, or the way that Ukraine would want, because the Biden administration is very clearly, and it has stated so, it's concerned about Russian nuclear use. So Russian nuclear deterrence is proving effective. Then let's move to the Middle East. So when over 100 Americans were murdered, what did the United States do? Did we, when we were attacked on 9/11, we launched a war on two countries. When 100 Americans were killed in Israel, we did nothing. We've shared some intelligence. We've sold some weapons. That's about it. Why? Because we're very clearly deterred by Iran, because this was clearly an Iran-backed attack. And because Iran is a latent nuclear weapon state, we're afraid to participate in a strong way. And then if you look at their other front in this conflict, and that is the front in the, the Red Sea, we've lost, the effort to try to engage against the Houthis in the Red Sea. The Iranians are winning. And we're unwilling to take that fight directly to the Iranians, because their deterrent as a latent nuclear state is effectively deterring us. And then let's go to Taiwan. What are we supporting Taiwan in a way that we could and should know? Why? Because China is a expanding nuclear power, and they're changing both the size, scope, and policies that govern their nuclear arsenal, and we're deterred. Then let's go to South Korea. Have we fundamentally done what it takes to effectively provide a deterrent to the South Koreans? No. The Washington Declaration, what do? We port a, we port a boomer. We've made some hand gestures, but that's about it. We've not actually done anything. Why? Because we don't want to agitate the North Koreans. And so what it's proven is that this idea that we're going to have a 2 MRC strategy is total garbage. We can't do it. We can't even do tiny conflicts anywhere and do those well. And it's because one reason: nuclear deterrence is working. Every one of our adversaries is using nuclear weapons to deter us from actively engaging. To me, this is how I read this. And Dave's article is a good one, and he makes good points. But I would submit to you that the problem is even worse than Dave sort of lets on in the article.
Yep. But Adam, I absolutely agree on that nuclear deterrence side. But, and again, maybe my angle is a little bit different, but our commitment to having, boots on the ground, airmen on the ground, seamen on the ground. I don't know if that sounds right. But folks in the area to show that commitment to other countries reduces the sample set on these flame ups, these fire ups that may occur. With non-nuclear countries, where we can bring the sample set down only to the nuclear opponents, which at least reduces us to several opponents versus everyone. And I see that as
our adversaries are all nuclear armed. Mm-hmm. We've got 50,000 U.S. troops in Europe. That mm-hmm. didn't make a damn bit of difference. We've got, you know, 10,000 troops, good troops, in North mm-hmm. or in South Korea. But yet the North Koreans have engaged in more than 100 provocations over the years, killing American soldiers on the DMZ. And then if you look at what the Chinese are doing, they're our allies, our treaty allies. They're harassing. They're doing all kinds of stuff. They're not afraid of the United States. So the idea that having U.S. troops in the region is going to make a difference, it doesn't. We've got them. We've always had them. It's something other than having troops there, because if we doubled American troops in Europe, do you think the Russians would be scared at that point? I don't.
Well, let me add, Adam, it's a fascinating assessment of that article. I confess I hadn't looked at it that way, and I'm embarrassed that I hadn't seen it that way. So thank you for making me a little bit smarter. Let me just react to a couple of your arguments here. First of all, with regard, I think you're spot on. I mean, everybody who we are, you know, got our dukes up with is basically either a nuke power or under the wings of a nuke power. But so let's look at this. I mean, we're talking about, there was an article recently, and I apologize, I don't remember the gentleman's name. I think it was in War on the Rocks or Real Clear Defense. I feel bad. I should be more prepared. But his argument is that Iran has weaponized the threat of making nuclear weapons. They essentially are behaving like mm-hmm. a nuclear deterrent power without any nuclear weapons, just because they are able to make the threat to say, if you keep doing it, we'll go nuke in a week. So maybe that's a methodology for Japan in the future, or perhaps even South Korea. If Iran has proven that they can weaponize just the threat of the possibility, maybe there's something there. Let me push over to North Korea. They just had a defense pact agreement with Putin. This totally changes, I think, the meaning of the Washington Declaration. And I actually think the South Koreans, not only should they relook their decision to garner nukes on the peninsula, either organically or from an ally, that they should start discussing that. Because, President Yoon released, a statement that said he wasn't going to pursue nuclear weapons because he did not want to immiserate the country economically by the sanctions that he believes South Korea would be put under for proliferating. In other words, he was more scared of his allies than he was of his adversary in what they would do to him in peacetime. And I think that is the mark of not a very good ally. And so we should be concerned about it. You mentioned harassing our allies in theater by the Chinese. I think you're referring to the Philippines. Sure. And you're right, they are an ally, but let's remind our listeners that the Philippines ratified the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons.
TPNW.
The TPNW. It is illegal for them to accept our nuclear deterrent or to allow us to even have nuclear weapons anywhere near their waters or their borders or any of that. So they are pretty well... in an isolated manner, in the sense that they are a conventional ally in that sense. And that's why I would hear, even on this podcast, if there's anyone from the Philippines listening, I highly recommend that you petition your government and de-ratify that treaty. Is that the right word, Adam? De-ratify?
Withdraw.
Fair enough. So those are just a couple things here. I think to Dave's article here, the effect of unextended deterrence, the idea that if our allies see, we argue in that nuclear extended deterrence, that if we don't provide enough deterrent, they may nuke up, or the value of our nuclear extended deterrent threat is that they won't nuke up. But we never carry the argument further, which I think Dave Trachtenberg does in this piece very well, which is, hey, if they're not convinced that we have the conventional capability, they might nuke up. Because they don't have the conventional capability, either because they can't afford it or they don't have the population for it or whatever the case may be. And so if we're going to try to replace our conventional capability and as an extended deterrent so that we don't have to have more nukes, then we've got to decide how we're going to spend money. And the FY25 NDAA has a 1% increase. And with a 3% inflation rate plus, that is a 2% cut. That is the wrong time to be cutting. And this administration, unfortunately, is the one doing that cutting.
Well, the big problem, this is one of the things we never talk about, because this is one of the challenges with being a defense person, and especially being a nuke person, because we segment and we segregate our arguments to, you know, the very technical and very specific, but we don't talk about the broader one. Like, the broader one we're going to have to talk about is we're going to have to engage in a guns versus butter debate. And what do you get? Mm-hmm. It does America, you know, is America a better, stronger country because we spend, you know, $2 trillion a year in the redistribution of wealth? And I can tell you, I've never seen a study that says economic growth goes up as you redistribute more income. In fact, it does the opposite. It goes down. Countries are not stronger for spending more on butter. They're not. They are stronger for spending more on guns to a point. You can't be, you know, the Soviets and spend 15 or 20% of your GDP in peacetime on it. You can't do that. But if you spend 5%, 6%, 7%, you guarantee the ceilings of commerce. You guarantee peace and stability because you spend enough to avoid fighting wars, which are a lot more expensive. That's what you do with it. And that's what America seems to have forgotten, is that our return on investment for butter is really, really low. And what you do is, when you spend all this money on butter, anything you subsidize, you get more of. So if, you know, Johnson, Lyndon Baines Johnson said, we're going to end poverty. So what did we do after, you know, we're 60 years into the Great Society? Well, we have more poverty. Why? Because when you subsidize something, you get more of it. And then what happens when you subsidize something? It gets more expensive. Universities and K through 12 education, the more the government spends on them, the more expensive they get. So we've got to really look at how we spend money and what our return on it is, because what we'll find is that spending on defense, and then more specifically spending on nuclear weapons, gives you a far greater return on your investment than spending on all of these redistribution programs do. They just do. There's just no two ways about it. But we never have that debate.
Yeah, Adam, I appreciate that view, and I'll stop playing my devil's advocate role here and sort of jump into the fray here. Because first of all, regarding the studies on economics, for what it's worth, I recently read, and I could search for it, and if someone wants to write me, there was a study done in Canada, Quebec versus, I think it was Alberta, in which Quebec was more socially oriented in their funding for poverty programs, and Alberta was much, much less. And so they provided those as a microcosm to fighting poverty, and we'll get more all out of that in a second. But my point is, poverty actually was increased with social programs that funded poverty, which leads to your point. But the real question here is the question of what does the lack of what does the peace and prosperity buy us? Aside from the funding part of it, it also provides us the many things that I'm wearing. For those on the YouTube cast, you'll see I'm wearing my 4th of July clothing, because we are recording this the day before 4th of July, in which we celebrate independence. And we want to have the freedoms, those freedoms that allow for economic freedom and personal freedom that we have fought for and paid for already. It's been bought and sold already. And if you lose that through a war, you lose that through through neglect of managing that, then other countries can take advantage of that and take those freedoms away. We live in a country that just has such great potential to grow and grow, like you said, economically, personally, and it's the greatest country in the world. And we have to orient ourselves away from worrying about what our adversaries are going to say, and instead worry about what freedoms we're going to protect and manage and maintain for the future. Because without them, you're right, we're going to lose it. One last thing, because I know Curtis just chomped a bit, but I want to go back to where I was sort of heading with the deployed forces issue. And this is really a nuclear issue, because there's a delay in what happens when you take your foot off the pedal with the nuclear weapon development, and that is it takes time to redevelop the capabilities, to reassess the funding, to reassess the skill sets, to reassess the actual product that comes out on the end. And we're going to reach a point where we're too far behind, because our adversaries already have their foot on the gas pedal. And this is where, when Curtis said the extended deterrence is helping the non-nuclear adversaries, our allies for whom we provide an extended nuclear deterrence, they've got to see what's happening, and that's got to make them, you know, take a second thought on this, because the nuclear is what's keeping that peace and prosperity for them. Go ahead, Curtis. I know you're just jumping on this.
No, I just want to add a few things here, so we're going to start wrapping things up here. One thing Dave Trachtenberg does is when he writes these articles, they're very well researched. And he cites a European Council on Foreign Relations survey that was done called Keeping America Close, Russia Down, and China Far Away: How Europeans Navigate a Competitive World. It's about 15,000 Europeans across 11 countries in Europe were surveyed. A couple of interesting things here that he noted was that 2020, there were 66% of the Europeans believed that they should be prepared to, if you will, prepare for their own defense without a United States, a strong United States, if you will. I'm paraphrasing the actual quote here. And then in 2023, that number was increased to 74%. So it went up 8 points under the current administration. Now, it's not an indictment on the current administration. It's a notice that it was already pretty high under the previous administration. My guess is it was probably pretty high under the Obama administration as well. But largely with the Ukraine war and the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, those numbers went up 8 points. I mean, you could say, well, that's a big increase, or that's not a big increase. That really just sort of depends on your perspective. But when we look at this, when you break out the numbers, the Europeans, 64% of those surveyed said that Russia is either a rival or an adversary. And of that 55% actually said it was an adversary. Only 9% said it was a rival. And so this indicates that despite the whole idea that NATO is not paying, all of NATO is not paying its 2% GDP, they're in the midst of a war in Ukraine, and they're still, and they even view Russia, two-thirds view Russia as an adversary. There is an expectation, I think, that as much as they want to complain or about a fear, a boogeyman that America is not going to be there for NATO, they still have this expectation that there's a real problem out here. And if they're not going to arm up, they're going to look to us to do it. And under the two major theater war concept, the idea was is that we had to have that capability so that NATO would look to us as that leader. But at the same time, in the same survey, 62% of the Europeans, so we're pretty close to who the number that believes Russia's a threat, believes that Europe should remain neutral if there is a conflict between U.S. and China over Taiwan. Those allies aren't going to be there. Those allies aren't. They're interested in being neutral. They're not interested in getting engaged and helping this NATO ally. And so when we look at this idea here, is that if you are going to base a large portion of your national security expectation, your global reach on willing allies, you better make sure, A, they're actually willing, and B, they have the capability to do that. And I'll leave you with one last thought. When Les Aspin first came up with the win-hold-win strategy in 1993, he used the 1991 Gulf War numbers as sort of the emphasis. What he didn't take into account when he calculated how many Air Force wings, or I should say maybe just air wings, that were needed to fight and win that kind of war, was that a third of all of the air power was allied. Yeah. And so the numbers were flawed from the very beginning, and they were never corrected, and they continue even to today in what is the number of combat-coded air wings or squadrons, however you want to calculate them, are needed to actually fight and win one of these wars. And we can't forget that no matter where you are deployed around the world fighting a war, you need to have air defense capability here at home as well, and that's a number of wings that is often forgotten when the war planners are thinking about, how am I going to get all my stuff over to the peninsula? So I'll leave you with that. Just a couple of ideas here in that regard. But kudos to Dave Trachtenberg for writing this piece.
Fortunately, we are out of time. And as always, we are your Drive Time podcast. And we want to keep it that way. Even for DC folks, maybe we want to allow you to squeeze in at least part of a second podcast. So we'll go ahead and stop now. And so, of course, Jim Curtis, thanks for joining us again. And of course, we always want to thank you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode. And as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.